Hi, I'm Rich Burrows, and I'm a community manager at Gremlin.
And I'm Jacob Plick, a solutions architect at Gremlin. And welcome to Break Things on Purpose, a podcast about chaos engineering.
So welcome to episode 3. We're really excited about this interview that we did with Paul Osmond from Under Armour. It's been really fun to get to talk to different people about their chaos engineering experiences, and Paul has a lot to share.
Absolutely. But before we get started, just a reminder that you can reach out to us through email or Twitter if you have feedback, questions, or comments. Our email address is podcast@gremlin.com, and our Twitter handle is @BTOPPod, so BTOPPOD.
So Jacob, what did you find most interesting from our conversation with Paul?
So my biggest takeaway was around just listening to Paul and him talking about his chaos engineering practice and how it's changed overall from company to company, effectively his like personal chaos engineering maturity and how that's changed as he moved onward and upward. What about you?
Yeah, mine was the exact same thing. So he starts off doing manual chaos engineering about 5 years ago, I think he said. And then he moves to PagerDuty, where they already had a program in place that was pretty sophisticated. And then he goes to Under Armour, where there wasn't a chaos engineering practice, and he bootstraps that. And I think that having that, you know, doing chaos engineering over that length of time in those different kind of circumstances gives him a really unique point of view that a lot of us don't have.
Exactly. And it allows folks like us and folks like our listeners out there to learn more. So with that, let's get to the interview with Paul.
Hi, today we're speaking with Paul Osmond. Paul leads the site reliability engineering team at Under Armour. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yes, indeed. Awesome to have you. I'd like to kind of kick things off, starting a little bit about your background and what kind of brought you into the chaos engineering space.
Yeah, certainly. So I think going back, the first time I got exposed to chaos engineering was probably from, you know, watching folks like Adrian Cockcroft or, you know, Nora Jones talk about like stuff that's going on at Netflix, and started practicing it at a startup that I used to work at in Toronto called 500 Pixels. We were in a very common space where, you know, the product had been built using a monolithic framework, in particular Rails. And a lot of components of the app, a lot of the features were really tightly coupled. So we started looking at migrating things into microservices and starting to develop new features that way. That allowed us to start thinking about resiliency. So as we were designing new features using this new architectural pattern, we were able to think about failure from the get-go. So, you know, I was part of a team there that started actually practicing game days. So every time we would launch a new product, you know, we would put it in production. We would make sure that, you know, all of the things that we did to try to account for failure were actually working by kind of forcing those failure conditions. It was very manual back then, but a really great way to kind of, you know, get introduced to the process and start to learn more about like good ways of doing it. From there, I started working at PagerDuty, and PagerDuty, I mean, as most people who are familiar with them know, have a really great reputation for resiliency. Working there was kind of like a masterclass in, you know, in doing chaos experimenting. They, you know, the infrastructure and site reliability engineering teams there led a practice called Failure Fridays. So every Friday, they would pick a team and basically say, like, we're going to attack your services. And kind of go through a runbook where, you know, they would try, you know, cutting off connection between services and various data stores, making sure that, you know, things failed over properly. And having that, like, you know, regular routine kind of health check was a really interesting experience. So that's definitely how I got my start in this space in particular.
How long ago was it that you were doing this stuff at 500 Pixels?
So that would have been about, I'd say about 5 years ago now.
Wow. So you were on board pretty early on.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, what I think is particularly interesting there is the monolithic to, you know, microservices kind of transition. And as everyone knows, that's an incredibly an easy transition to make, right? So obviously speaking for those that for the uninitiated. But how did doing those experiments help with that journey? Did it, you know, kind of level set things? Did it help from like an agility perspective? What you saw?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. So we were already like the motivation, part of our motivation for microservices was reliability, but also just the company was in a growth spurt and they were looking at ways to, you know, allow engineering teams to do all the usual things that you want to do with microservices, like deploy independently, you know, not have to get into a big deploy queue, increase the rate of deploys, things like that. And so that was the big motivation, but also like going from a monolith to a microservices architecture allows you to just like rethink a lot of these failure strategies, you know. In particular, you know, we had I can think of the first experiment we did, first kind of game day we did, we were introducing a new search feature, and we decided to move all, you know, responsibility for search in the site to a separate service. And, you know, we didn't have any edge routing infrastructure or anything like that at the time. This was really like pretty rudimentary. We had CDN to a load balancer to Rails application servers. And, you know, what we were doing with microservices was, because we didn't have any edge routing infrastructure, we were really just calling out to the microservice from the Rails monolith. So the Rails monolith was evolving into a kind of edge routing component of our infrastructure. And so what that allowed us to do is, you know, when we were doing that search feature, we thought about all these things like, okay, if the service can't talk to Elasticsearch, what can happen then? If the monolith can't talk to the search service, you know, what happens then? And things that, you know, used to be automatic cascading failures for us just started, you know, we started being able to handle them more gracefully. So instead of saying like Elasticsearch is having trouble, the whole site's, you know, unusable or the whole app's unusable, instead we were able to say like search will 503, it'll like fail fast. So users in the interface can get like a nice little dialog box saying search isn't working right now, please try again later. And that was just a hugely positive experience for us. So it increased the reliability of the site quite a bit. And I would say there's a trade-off for sure, but it definitely did increase velocity for certain teams.
So then you show up at Under Armour. Was there a chaos engineering program already when you got there, or did you end up kicking that off?
No, that was something I ended up kicking off. I started at Under Armour as a staff software engineer. So here what that means is I was really responsible for working between all of these different teams, kind of building, you know, platform components that we would use to integrate all of our various products. For those who maybe aren't familiar, Under Armour is the parent company of products like MyFitnessPal and MapMyFitness and Endomondo. So it was really interesting coming into this company where we had three different products that were all, you know, the product of acquisitions. And so these were consumer products that were built in their own way. They used different stacks. They used different architectural patterns. And so my first responsibility was like building out platform components that helped us integrate those or improve the integration between the apps. But then I started managing backend services teams, and that's where I introduced chaos engineering. I think the first thing we did, it was really like dipping our toe into this space. For MyFitnessPal in particular, we have this huge traffic spike every New Year's. Users who are downloading the app again, who, you know, maybe were previous users who churned and like they're renewing their commitment to, you know, improving their awareness of their fitness. And obviously, from our perspective, you know, we also have a lot of people who are downloading the app for the first time, and we want to make sure that that experience is really, really good so that we can retain as many of those users and hopefully turn them into year-long users. So the first time I went through that exercise where we were with the team, where we were doing all the pre-scaling and kind of capacity planning for this traffic spike, I decided that, you know, we would test out a few kill switches in the app. You know, these were things where the team had already designed this functionality. And the idea behind it was like, if there was a problem with, let's say, a third-party integration or a cluster of asynchronous task workers or something like that, let's make sure that we can turn that feature off instead of having, you know, a queue backup cause problems for the rest of the app or something like that. The idea being, of course, like, if your step tracking isn't working, you should still be able to log your food.
So that's a really, really important concept in distributed systems. And it's one that a lot of companies seem to be embracing more. That idea of just, you know, turning off parts of the system that aren't functioning, but making sure that there's still a good user experience for the parts that are. Like the fact that, you know, part of the application isn't working shouldn't prevent you from doing other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And failing to do that or not having the support and infrastructure in place to be able to turn off those features of the app that may not be as central to a user experience, it results in this familiar pattern, I think, for a lot of organizations where every incident becomes, you know, a sev one. You know, if anything is failing, then everything is failing. And, you know, users are, of course, hugely impacted by that. And you see that show up in revenue loss, you see it show up in churn reports and, you know, in various other areas. So our first real chaos experiment here was actually getting together like, you know, a month before New Year's and shutting off all these parts of the app in production and making sure that that operation was clean and that we could bring things back online, you know, just as easily. And that's where, you know, we introduced our customer happiness team to the process. We made sure that they were, you know, in the loop and that they were, you know, sending out notifications and broadcasts to users saying, look, there might be a 5-minute interruption in some step tracking functionality. We're doing some routine maintenance and testing. And it was received really well. I didn't know how this was going to go, frankly. But, you know, I sort of announced that we were going to be doing this. And thankfully, you know, our chief digital officer was like, that sounds like a really good idea, actually. And so, you know, we just kept doing it.
It's one of those things that I think people sometimes have a little bit of fear, you know, around making some of these changes and doing chaos engineering. And, you know, as scary as a step like that might be, you know, the idea is that it's going to, you know, prevent bigger outages down the road that are going to be a lot more harmful to the company.
That's right. You know, one of the things I often recommend to people who are looking at picking this practice up in their organization or trying to sell this internally, if you already have some kind of incident response process fairly well documented, that makes it a lot easier. So if you're already like reporting on incidents and, you know, making sure that there's awareness around severities of incidents and frequency of incidents and, you know, recording things like mean time to resolve, then it's really easy, I think, to make the case that, look, these failures are going to happen. Let's make them happen when we're all awake and we're all in a room and we're all ready for it. You know, to your point, that's like something that you can use, I think, to alleviate some of that fear sometimes.
Yeah, especially when you can tie it directly into some business objectives, right? And that really helps with the executive alignment, like the fact that the chief digital officer, though I can imagine there was some internal thought initially, but, you know, was, you know, able to kind of give the green light, you know, really ties into that. Because if reliability is a P0 in the organization, then, you know, chaos engineering is definitely something to look at. You mentioned the customer happiness team. Is that actually the name of the incident management team?
No, I should clarify. Sorry. That's our frontline customer support team. So they're the great folks who answer all the emails from customers, who, you know, manage our support Twitter account, who, you know, field all of our inquiries and just help our users be successful.
Sure. The first line of defense, so to speak, right? You know, and they're able to kind of escalate things if incidents do happen, you know, based off of those reports. I mean, hopefully, you know, the idea is to catch those things before that, right? Obviously. And that tells the full tale, I think, a little bit. But yeah, the reason I asked, I thought that was, I was like, man, if that's the name, like, man, it's a brilliant name.
I love that, actually. Now you're making me think about reorgs and things like that. It's like, you know, that's the goal. Like that's a great culture value, actually. If you can kind of encode that, is like the goal of all this stuff is to make our customers happy. And, you know, I've always described one of the things that really attracts me to this field, to reliability engineering specifically, is it's like one of those rare areas that almost involves no trade-offs. Reliability is good for customers. It's good for engineers because you're going to get paged less. And when you do get paged, hopefully it's something that's urgent, so you don't have to waste that executive decision-making ability. And it's good for the business because it improves revenue, it lowers churn, it does all those healthy things. So like, I'm now actually thinking, like, how can we make our team like advertised as like the customer happy?
It's really interesting because like a lot of it is about that, you know, it really trends upwards from there, because if you're making your customers happy, your customers are buying. And then if that's happening, your engineers are getting paged less, so they're happy and they're able to shift to, you know, being more agile and doing more interesting things and, you know, making the overall environment better from that aspect. So it's a part of a huge culture shift, I think. And I think it's really awesome to see.
Cool. Yeah, I completely agree.
So Paul, if you were talking to somebody at a company that didn't have an established chaos engineering practice yet, and they were trying to get up and running, what kind of advice would you give them?
That's a really great question. It's one I get a lot, actually. Yeah, I've done conference talks on this. You know, I've done some lightning talks on this. I should have an answer at the ready, but it's not always.
So how about in terms of like pitching it to the executive specifically?
Yeah. So I think before you're able to do that, and I hate to put like, you know, you have to be this tall to ride this ride kind of like limitations on people. But I really do think you have to have a few things in place already. You know, one of them is like, you have incidents. No software organization in the world doesn't have incidents. If they do, I want to find out what they're doing. How you currently deal with those incidents, I think, is going to really establish the culture that you're starting from. And so, you know, like I said, mentioned earlier, like having a good incident response process, I think, is like step one. So that means, you know, having engineers be on call for their own code, for the code that they ship to production, that they operate. That means, you know, having some tool like PagerDuty that can put people on call and have escalation policies and schedules so that you have a fairly, you know, good certainty that when things do happen, the right person's going to get paged. you know, having good communication in place so that non-engineering stakeholders, you know, like execs and product managers and, you know, customer support people have awareness about what's going on. From there, you can start to at least address reality. You know, you can start to look at like, look, we are having incidents. Things are happening that impact our customers negatively. And, you know, if you don't have that, I think it's really hard to start talking about like, hey, we're going to start breaking things, you know, that's putting the cart before the horse in a lot of ways. So the other thing that I think you have to have in place is at least some, you know, some kind of decent observability. There's plenty of people who have spoken much more eloquently about this than I can, but like, you know, if you can't see what's going on in your production environment, if you can't easily look at basic red metrics, you know, request error rate, duration of requests for, you know, any service in your infrastructure, then you really aren't prepared to start doing this stuff and it's really not going to go well. So I wouldn't even start to try to convince execs that this is something you want to do.
Yeah, the way I like to think of it is that, you know, this is an experiment we're doing, right? And we're injecting this failure and we want to measure the results, and our observability tools are how we measure the results. So if you don't have those, you can't really experiment.
That's exactly right. It's not an experiment at that point. It actually is just chaos.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, it's tough to, even before you click the button to kick off an experiment, you want to have a well-defined hypothesis, right? And it's a little more difficult to be able to build one if you don't have what you expect. Like you touched on response rates, right? If I'm injecting 100 milliseconds of latency and I don't know what that even looks like, you know, maybe I'm just clicking the UI of my application versus looking at a dashboard that tells me what that looks like. And if that doubles, triples, affects my request or my timeout logic, I'm not seeing the full picture. And I want to make sure that at least that baseline is in there before I get started.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I completely agree. And then I think like once you have those things in place, then you're ready to start testing this idea internally and see how it might be received. And at that point, I think it all depends on your company culture. Like, I don't think that there's one runbook that's going to work for everybody. You know, if you have a very conservative culture, you might want to think about, you know, some conservative examples. Like one of the favorites that I always go to is, look, banks do disaster recovery. You know, like, you know, they have a stigma of sometimes being like conservative technical organizations, but they do this stuff on the regular because they have to. And so maybe phrasing it as like a disaster recovery, you know, game day or, you know, something like that might be more effective for your culture. Luckily at Under Armour, I mean, our engineering organization is pretty autonomous. When Under Armour acquired MapMyFitness, MyFitnessPal, and Antimondo, it was very clear from the get-go that Under Armour understood, like, we're hiring you because you know how to do engineering. And so within those organizations, we already had a culture that was very much like, teams, you know what to do. Teams have the bandwidth to do it. Let's let teams experiment with processes, and then let's pick up what works, you know. So that's pretty much how we approached it here. But at other places, you might need a little bit more, you know, formal buy-in.
So I'm actually really curious about, I was chatting with Rich a little earlier, and he mentioned that you spoke at Kafka Summit. And I wanted to kind of know what your experience is with Kafka as a whole and how you kind of see it. The reason why I ask is when we had Chaos Conference last year, back in September, we had a bunch of folks come up and talk to, you know, essentially we worked it as like a chaos engineering, you know, chat with a chaos engineer, build an experiment, things like that. And the number one application that we heard about was Kafka, which then kind of tied into like a blog that one of our coworkers did. But so I'm curious to your experience with that and what that looks like for you right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah, we're really big Kafka users. I mentioned when I first started at Under Armour, I was working as an engineer on a platform team here. Kafka was a big part of my job. The team I was on, what we were working on and what we ended up building was a messaging platform built on top of federated Kafka brokers, Kafka clusters. So, you know, different parts of the organization would have their own cluster. And we have a topology service that really allows you to say, like, here's a namespace and an event name. And your application doesn't need to know exactly where the brokers and the zookeeper clusters are, or like, you know, doesn't need to do service discovery. It just talks to this topology service and then it routes those messages to the right cluster. And you can do that for producing and for consuming messages. And there's a whole bunch of reasons internally why that's a really good fit for us. So what that's allowed is more and more services, more and more features are being developed with this kind of evented model in mind, where, you know, something happens in one part of the system that puts a message into a Kafka, you know, message bus. And then there's consumers that are, you know, sitting in consumer groups consuming this stuff and doing actual work. And, you know, that shows up quite a lot in game days. We tend to, you know, look at things like, what happens when you just kill off all the consumers? You know, what do we know about like things like retention windows or, you know, log size on the actual Kafka brokers? But also like what happens when you, you know, start those consumers back up? Or how do you guarantee that you're consuming all of the messages in the right way, depending on the business need? And so I would say that for us, it's actually been really nice because not depending on solely synchronous network RPCs just has allowed us all of these different ways that we can fail gracefully, you know? But we haven't actually done any chaos testing on Kafka itself. That would be something I would be very interested in.
So yeah, so our coworker Tammy Buto actually did a little bit of that. She posted a tutorial that's up on gremlin.com/community. So
I saw that. I'm very curious to give that a go, actually.
Yeah, if folks are interested, they might want to take a look at that. It sounds like you're also using Kubernetes at Under Armour.
That's correct. We're about a year into our Kubernetes journey. So we're still in a hybrid environment. We have been migrating all of our services from two home-rolled orchestration platforms. That's kind of amazing. One of them used containers, the other does not. So you can imagine which one's easier to migrate from. But we started using Kubernetes about a year ago. We host our own Kubernetes clusters running in Amazon Web Services using tools like Kops. And yeah, it's been really, really good so far. Just can't wait to, you know, be 100% on Kubernetes.
Have you done experiments around that stuff?
We have. We've had one game day where we attacked Kubernetes. It was great, actually. We learned a lot in that one. One of the things, actually, this brings up something I think quite a lot about. You know, obviously, the main goal of chaos experiments is like resiliency and improving resiliency and inevitably improving availability for customers and whatnot. But the other side effect that we've noticed is like just increasing confidence amongst engineers, right? And with Kubernetes specifically, so our infrastructure team who operate our Kubernetes clusters, they led this one and they went through a bunch of different attack scenarios, including like what happens when you take out a whole availability zone in Amazon. You know, and we have a bunch of pods running on nodes in that availability zone, like what's happening. And, you know, they actually visualized like, you know, using dashboards, like the sort of pods all being rescheduled on different nodes and making sure that this happened in an adequate amount of time without affecting customer or without having any real customer impact. And so like, obviously, we learned a lot about Kubernetes in that game day, and we learned a lot about how our specific setup could be tweaked. There were a few places where just injecting a small amount of latency had a much bigger impact than, you know, we anticipated. Almost as importantly, you know, engineers who participated in that, and we have a thing, just an internal practice, game days are completely open. So I tend to invite everyone, you know, and not everyone comes, but a lot of engineers from different teams show up, even if it's not their team who's doing the game day. So we had a lot of people who were just curious about Kubernetes. And I think seeing us attack it and seeing how the clusters were able to kind of cope with these things because of various resiliency patterns inherent in Kubernetes increased people's understanding and confidence of the system.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Like you touched on comfort, which I think is so spot on, because I think a majority of the information and knowledge that I've built on Kubernetes has about 95% to do with running game days with it. So I'm right there with you on that. It's really interesting because one thing, right, is that it's very new still, right? You said you guys are about a year into your journey and there's a lot of folks that are just getting started. So I think maybe it's important to note, one, in my informational knowledge so far, is that Kubernetes is not easy, but I'd love to kind of know, just as from an overall standpoint, some things maybe, and maybe Kafka as well, things for folks to look out for when kickstarting that journey.
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, I think one thing that I've spoken to some organizations that have overlooked this point, you know, Kubernetes is open source. Kubernetes has a great community supporting it. And, you know, that's all fantastic, but you need a team if you are going to take this on. Yeah, you need an infrastructure team that's willing to really dive deep into Kubernetes and learn all of the ins and outs, because there are so many little like gotchas that depend on your environment, you know, like things that no one can give you a simple runbook. I think it was Alice Goldfuss, a SRE at GitHub. So she did a fantastic talk recently on GitHub's journey to containers into a container platform, specifically Kubernetes, and, you know, just nailed it, in my opinion. Like very much, I was sitting there nodding while I was watching the talk, like the types of skills that you need, the types of team organization that you need, and really that you have to be prepared to, like, you know, invest in this and really stub your toe a bit and learn.
Yeah. And I think that ties right back into the chaos engineering practice almost too perfectly.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me because we talk about this sometimes with, and I've actually heard Jacob talk about this before in some of our conversations about the fact that sometimes customers will kind of make excuses for why they can't move ahead with chaos engineering yet, you know? And one of those might be, oh, we're doing a migration to the cloud or a migration to Kubernetes or something like that. But from my perspective, that's a perfect time to start, right? When you're kind of tackling a new platform and you want to understand how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think admittedly, we're still a little bit into this, you know, this part of our journey. Chaos engineering is often thought as something you do as an afterthought. You know, like you've built everything, you've got it in production, now you're ready. Like you've got this like crazy strong system and you're going to test it, you know? But I think, and like I said, we're working on this at Under Armour. We're not there yet. I think the earlier though that you can build it into processes, that's where, you know, you can start to get a lot of payoff. And so if you're migrating to, let's say, you know, you're just going from bare metal to, you know, a cloud provider, or let's say you're investing in like a new configuration management system or a new infrastructure as code solution, or if you're moving to a platform like Kubernetes, you know, as you move things, how are you testing it? You know, like as you deploy stuff on this and put production workloads on this, how are you making sure that the resiliency stuff that you have in mind is actually working? You know, so that might be a great way to start flexing that muscle and working on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And even as something as small as, you know, the runbooks that you use for incident management and being able to build those out. Because most of the times, unfortunately, those things come out of postmortems from incidents. And, oh, man, we should have seen that coming. And, you know, this was the issue. And now we know how to fix it for next time. When it's a really powerful, this goes back to the executive alignment. How powerful is it to say, hey, what if we could have seen that, you know, seen that coming, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon a week ago versus now at 4 a.m.?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then that ties into, you know, depending on your company culture, that's great stuff that can be used to, like you said, you know, sell this stuff internally.
So I was interested by something you said a little earlier. You were talking about your game days and the fact that you invite everybody and there's, you know, different engineers from different teams that come. What do you think about using chaos engineering to sort of share information and get like a deeper learning of the system?
Oh, I love it. So I'll also just add, it's not just engineers who show up, which I'm super happy about. We've had lots of customer support people come. We've had product managers come. You know, part of me thinks that maybe they're just like, what the heck are this team doing?
Y'all are the cool kids. They want to see what the cool kids are up to.
I hope so. I hope they're not like, this is terrifying and I, you know, want to see it. But to your question, I really think that that's something that's not tapped enough. Like it's a really untapped potential. Something that we're starting to think about, and we haven't rolled this out yet. So, you know, hopefully this is something I could talk about tangibly soon, but I would love to use chaos engineering as part of our onboarding. Every company I've been a part of, even PagerDuty, they're as good as anyone at this. Onboarding people into the on-call rotation is painful. And inevitably, there's some point at which it kind of feels like, especially as a manager on teams, you're like, well, this is the deep end now, and I hope you know how to swim. You know, like you can certainly page people, you can do things, but, you know, this is it. And I can't help but think like there's a better way to maybe get someone to lead a game day so that the whole team's around, you know, like as a part of their introduction to on call.
No, that's a really powerful use case. Like Colton says it, one of my favorite lines he's ever made is like, here's your pager. Good luck.
Yeah. For those who might not know, Colton is our CEO at Gremlin. And actually in our first episode, we talked to a couple of our coworkers and Tammy Buto brought this very thing up, you know, about the fact that, you know, most folks just sort of throw people into that deep end when they put them on call, and that participating in some game days would be a great way to learn some things before you, you know, get put in the rotation and start getting pages. I think that, you know, it would give you some familiarity with observability software and a lot of other things.
Yeah. The other thing that actually we noticed, you know, to that point specifically, I was really glad to see a lot of mobile engineers in our company were attending game days. And it really piqued, I think, a lot of people's interest who hadn't done any sort of backend development. You know, and this is specifically game days that are attacking backend systems. And so like just having familiarity with some of our operational dashboards, with like how we look at metrics, how we use, you know, tracing, things like this to debug problems, sparked a lot of interest. And as a direct result of that, we have a bunch of mobile engineers who want to do game days now. And I'm super excited about having a mobile-led game day. And we also have mobile engineers who are really interested in backend systems and want to start, you know, learning new languages and programming backend systems and seeing if they can expand their horizons a bit and like get a bit more full stack there.
Well, I want to hear about your mobile game days when those happened. That sounds great.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Was it, just to kind of clarify, was it like they kind of walked into the game day and left like, huh, that's interesting. I never thought about, you know, that piece of our infrastructure in that way. I want to learn more about it.
Absolutely. So a specific case I'm thinking of is we have a woman named Lisa on our Android team who had been, you know, attended a game day. And so was familiar with the fact that we did this every so often. And then I think it was like a month later, she was working with another engineer on recreating this problem that customers were having. It was like this very intermittent bug. You know, I forget the details of the bug, but it was something to do with saving a workout in MapMyFitness. And, you know, sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. And what they were finding is it would only work under like really poor network conditions. And so she actually approached me and was like, this sounds like something that we could do at game day around, you know, like we're jumping through all these sorts of hoops trying to recreate these situations in like staging environments and stuff like that. Why don't we just like organize a game day where we attack some of our backend systems by adding this packet loss or, you know, what have you, and see how the mobile experience is. So this has actually spawned us to spark some interest in using Alfie to like really do targeted application level fault injection, which is, you know, something on our roadmap that I really hope that we can get going soon.
So yeah, again, for those who might not be familiar with it, Alfie is a feature of our Gremlin tool that lets you inject failures like within your application as opposed to some of the infrastructure attacks that we do.
Yep, at the request level. So a very small blast radius and gets very specific and very interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
So Paul, I'm a community manager is my role. And I know that you all at Under Armour host the Chaos Meetup down there in Austin. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, unfortunately, we haven't done one in a while. So thanks for the reminder. So actually, I mean, that's another great story for us. So the two people who organized the first Chaos Engineering meetup in Austin are Tammy Buteau, who obviously works at Gremlin, and a guy named Matthew Brams, who I don't remember what company he was working at in Austin, but he was a really big enthusiast and, you know, just a big active community member in the Chaos Engineering community. And we offered our space and, you know, we sort of hosted and I did a talk at the first one and Colton came and did a talk as well, which was a lot of fun. And Matthew ended up applying to Under Armour and now works for us on our infrastructure team. And it was just such a great example of like how this stuff, you know, talk loudly about what you do because you'll attract the people who are interested in it. And he's been a fantastic addition to our infrastructure team here.
That's awesome. Yeah, I
love Matthew's great. Yeah, I met him up at KubeCon and he's pretty active in our community Slack that we have as well. So yeah, that's great. I think that honestly, it's one of those things like using Kubernetes or other things that are kind of seen as a little bit more cutting edge in the industry. I think it really is potentially a recruiting advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've mentioned that to our recruiting team internally, and they've said it resonates with a lot of people when they talk to them, when they're doing like preliminary screens or when they're just trying to sell candidates on Under Armour, you know, just mentioning or pointing to, you know, some of the talks that we've done that folks here have done has been a really big advantage.
Well, Paul, I think that's all the time that we have today. This was a super fun conversation. Thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I had a blast. It was great to talk.
Where can people find you on the internet, like on the Twitters and places?
Yeah, so I'm somewhat active on the Twitters. My handle is pretty simple. It's Paul Osman, one word, no underscores or anything. GitHub is the same. You know, pretty much everywhere on the internet, I'm Paul Osman.
Okay, I will just start looking for Paul Osmans on random apps and see if it's you. Thanks again, Paul.
Hey, thank you both. Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Jacob.
Our music is from Kumiku. The song is titled Battle of Pogs. For more of Kumiku's music, visit loyaltyfreakmusic.com or click the link in the show notes. For more information about our Chaos Engineering community, visit gremlin.com/community. Thanks for listening and join us next month for another episode.